CityTalk 105.9. Official podcasts. Online at citytalk.fm. CityTalk 105.9. The best of Roy Basnett.
Hello and welcome to this week's podcast. Each week we will be bringing you some of the best moments from our award-winning programme on CityTalk 105.9, The Voice of Liverpool. This week we're going to hear from one of the most famous psychics on TV. Colin Fry took the country by storm with his series The Sixth Sense and Psychic Private Eyes, but he didn't go looking for fame, as he told me when I caught up with him.
CityTalk 105.9, the best of Roy Basnett.
Hello, Roy.
Colin, somewhat of a privilege for me to be speaking to you. I regard you within the field who operates as being one of the A-listers.
Well, that's very kind of you. Thank you.
Right, so let's make a start then and find out a little bit about Colin Fry. Colin, when did it all start for you, this business?
Oh, really, in childhood. I don't think I can remember a time when, you know, this wasn't part of my life. I mean, I started working over 30 years ago when I was 17 and started working on platform in spiritualist churches. It was really my mum that guided me into that at first, and then an elderly medium in Brighton took me under her wing and gradually sort of introduced me into the spiritualist church movement.
Prior to actually going to the church then, Colin, what was it that was happening to you that made you think, you know, hey, there's something...
I think one of my family's earliest memory is of me telling my grandfather at four that his mother had passed away. And of course, in those days, you know, people didn't have telephones. You know, the telephone used to be the one on the corner of the road.
Yeah.
But the following day, my grandfather got a telegram to confirm that his mother had indeed passed away the previous afternoon at exactly the time that I'd announced this. Now, I don't remember that, but that particular experience from my family do. But the earliest one that I can remember is I was brought up in an age when, you know, if parents had visitors, you know, you were seen and not heard, you know, and you were just expected, you know, to play quietly. And I'd have been about six or seven, I suppose, and this lady come to visit my mum. And my mum obviously knew, but I'd never met her. And when this lady had left the house and gone, I remember saying to my mum, why did that lady ignore the little boy with her?
Right.
And my mum said, what little boy? And I said, John. And she said, darling, you can't possibly have seen John. And I said, yeah, I did. There's this little boy, John, you know, and he had curly hair. And my mum went into a cupboard and she raked out some photographs and said, do you mean this little boy? And I went, yes, John. And she said, you can't have seen him, dear. He died 4 years before you were born. He was that lady's son.
Right.
So that was the first memorable experience for me. But of course, I was an age not really to be able to make too big a thing of it. And I think when it really struck home to me was when I was 11. I was walking home from school one day and my grandfather had passed away the previous year. And an ambulance went speeding by. And I clearly heard my grandfather's voice say to me that I'd got to run home as quickly as possible because the ambulance was for my mum. And I ran all the way home and sure enough the ambulance was parked outside the house and my mum had slipped and fallen down the stairs. Now, thankfully, she wasn't too badly hurt, but it was the experience that made me realise that all these experiences I'd been having through my childhood was I was seeing what other people were calling dead people and hearing, you know, the voices of dead people and sensing dead people in rooms, you know.
Right.
And I suppose because it had always been a part of my life, I wasn't really fazed by it. It was just this conundrum at 11 of trying to know exactly what I was supposed to do with it.
Right.
And then, of course, as the years went on through my teenage years and I began to learn the responsibilities that go with it. It became my life.
It's interesting because we theorise quite a lot on this show as to, you know, what this ability is all about and why I get it. And the latest one that we're looking at is, I don't know if you're familiar, you know, kids who behave in an antisocial behaviour of a certain age, youngsters, there's a new piece of equipment out called the Mosquito. I don't know if you're familiar with it. What that does, it sends out high-pitched signals that
only children can pick up.
And I'm just wondering whether or not, because you hear all these stories all the time about youngsters hearing things and, you know, older people not. And I'm just wondering whether or not this can be applied to that situation in terms of spirit voices.
I think the thing is that there's so many theories, and there are some people that have done some, you know, some interesting work on this. You know, there's a gentleman in America called Professor Gary Schwartz who's really looked into it. But the challenge for mediums that become involved in this type of research work is that you you know, you can do a series of experiments and research with one scientist or one scientific establishment,
yeah,
and they'll come up with results. And of course, because of the contentious nature of our work, there will always be another group of researchers or scientists or,
yeah,
or skeptics that will tear it all apart.
Yeah, yeah.
And I actually just don't think that there's a set criteria yet by which these things can be examined. And I think, you know, the challenge is that by the very nature of this ability, it isn't something that is easily laboratory, you know, studied in a laboratory.
Mm, yeah.
And I remember once, you know, a colleague of mine once said, actually, rather than scientists assessing their work, maybe it should be lawyers and barristers that assess their work, because they're used to analysing evidence.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of looking at it, though.
I have done work with various researchers and scientists over the years, but to be quite honest, I really got a little bit fed up with being treated like a laboratory rat.
Yeah.
And I realised that, in fact, actually, it was a distraction from what my work should really be about, which is be out there helping the public.
Yeah, I would have said that. I mean, if you've been given this gift, if you like, then it's not there for analysis, if you like. It's that you just do it.
I mean, unfortunately, we live in an age where acts of faith have almost become something that we should be embarrassed about. And I think, you know, that a lot of my audience or people that become involved in my work and with the work of people like me is that it is an act of faith that they accept.
Yeah.
You know what we do. You know, I quite often say, I'm not on an evangelistic cause. I'm not out to convert people.
No,
I do what I do. And if there is a proportion of the society that want to accept what I do and it helps them, great. And if there's another section of society that rejects what I do, that's fine. I'm not going to force it down their throat.
Mm.
But by the same token, they shouldn't condemn the people that do accept, you know, my work and the spirituality of it. It should be left down to people making their personal choices.
We are talking with Colin Fry. Colin, I noticed that, you know, part of your biography mentions that you were a trained bereavement counsellor.
Yeah, this has been quoted a lot, and I tried to correct it. What I realised when I started to work as a medium was that I and people like me are working with and dealing with very fragile human emotions. And I took the decision that because of that, I needed to go and get some ancillary skills and abilities to complement my work as a medium. So I went away and I studied counselling and I did some counselling courses. But it was so that I could use this in my work as a medium. I've not practiced as a counsellor, but I studied counselling because I thought it was an important part of my work as a medium.
Because you could arguably say that being a medium is a natural extension to that, if you like, that ability, you know, because it's almost is like bereavement counselling, because
if you don't have a compassion for people, then it's a gift that you should never pursue. It's not a gift that you should ever develop. If you don't feel compassionately about people, then I don't think that you would ever be any good as a medium.
Yeah. Do you find it frustrating, just going back to the analysis aspect of it, that, you know, that there are so many, because when you get people who don't believe, they don't just not believe, they believe with almost a violent rage, if you know, they don't believe.
You know, being so interested in counselling and psychology, and I quite often say to these very aggressive sceptics, you know, you really do need to go away and get some good, you know, psychological analysis, because there's something very, very wrong with you that you are so angry.
Yeah.
And I actually got a very well-known skeptic to actually admit the whole concept of dying and death terrifies him.
Mm.
And I actually think that for a lot of them that is the root of it. It's, you know, if you go out and investigate and look into spirit communication, if you go with an attitude that you're going out to find nothing to convince you, you will never find anything to convince you.
No.
So, you know, it's they're basically playing with it, you know, with a double-sided coin that's always going to tell them what they want.
Mm, yeah.
They're never going to find that evidence to convince them, because their attitude is always going to prohibit that.
Yeah. I do find it amazing that, like you just said there, many, many people, sceptic people, seem to have a fear of death. Well, surely if you believe, if you subscribe to the school of thought that when you die you turn to dust, then you're not answerable to anybody, so why should you be afraid of it? It's almost as if, like, you know, they're thinking there's that, maybe that element of doubt.
There is this thing in the human consciousness, which, you know, whether we want to call it the essence, the spirit, the soul, whatever, that does tell us that, you know, whether we continually do wrong in our life or not, we've got to answer for it at some point. It's intrinsically built into our makeup. And I think, you know, you cannot engage into research with the highly sceptically minded, because it's like trying to mix, you know, oil and water. It just won't happen. And you know, I realised this a few years back, and I thought, well, you know, we will just have to agree to disagree. And, you know, I do have friends of mine, you know, that say to me, don't you get upset by, you know, some of these things that are put on the internet about you. And I say, no, because these people don't know me. They don't know what makes me tick. And therefore, you know, every negative comment that they might make about me is purely their own assumption. Or their own vitriol. I can't be bothered with that anymore, because there's too many people out there that do want to participate in my work that I'm trying to help, and I have to focus on them.
Do you believe that perhaps maybe your position's not helped by the fact that there will be, as indeed there is in any walk of life, it doesn't matter whether it's football, whether it's car sales or whatever, there are a degree of people, a number of people, who are obviously telling lies. Do you think that not helps?
Of course it doesn't help. You know, but then... you know, there are bad doctors out there, bad lawyers, there are bad nurses. In every field where we would hope that we would be able to trust and respect people, there is always going to be people that abuse that. There are, you know, the just in any field, there are laws that govern these things. And that means, you know, that if we operate within the laws and we operate honourably, you know, the public, you know, can have some, you know, some trust in us. Although I'm the greatest supporter of people developing their abilities, the one thing that does gall me a little bit is, you know, they see the likes of, you know, me and John Edward, you know, and James Van Parr, you know, on television, and they think, oh, I can do that. And all, because what they don't realise is that for the likes of us, those of us that are on television, we've taken many, many years to get to this position. And I do get a little bit galled when you see these people think, oh, I can do that. And they go out and get their little cards printed, you know, professional medium, professional psychic. And they have, if you like, they haven't served the apprenticeship. You know, they haven't gone through, you know, the spiritualist movement of serving in churches and sitting in development circles and, you know, and not learning the ability, because you can't learn the ability, but certainly learning the discipline and the morality that goes with it.
This is the thing. I mean, I get literally inundated on this show with people who want to come on this show, and when they can't, when I get into conversation with many of them, within a very short period of time, they're saying, yes, well, I'm looking to get on television. Now, I wouldn't have thought, for most people who are really, really heavily into this subject, the primary motivation is not to gain stardom.
You know, can I tell you, when I was first approached to do The Sixth Sense, I turned it down 3 times,
right?
Because I didn't want to do television. I couldn't see the point of it. And then when the format of the show was explained to me, and I was told, you know, that, you know, this show will be built around, you know, what you say is right, and, you know, what you think this show should be about. It was only then that I agreed to do it. You know, I had to think very carefully about it. And I think, you know, for all of the, you know, the guys and girls that are, you know, on television and become high-profile television, I think it's very important, you know, that people realise that we were approached to do this. And all the high-profile people that I know, no one actually canvassed to go on television. We were approached to to make these series. And because of the fact that we had reputations of having been working for a very long time.
Right, you preempted me a little bit there. I was going to ask you about that. Tell us a little bit about how that actually came to be in The Sixth Sense. How did that come about?
Well, I think it would be fair to say that at the time, my production company were very impressed by things like John Edwards crossing over from America and wanted to do a British version of it. And it coincided with the fact that at the same time, Living TV were also looking to commission a British version or a British-styled programme in the vein of Crossing Over. The lady who was my producer emailed me, and I emailed very politely back and said, I'm sorry, I'm not interested. And she kept pursuing me. And in the end, I said, there are plenty of mediums out there. And I actually gave her the name of several well-known mediums and said, look, why don't you speak to these people? And, you know, maybe they might be interested, but I'm really not interested. And she said, well, the problem is, she said, everywhere I go when I speak in the spiritualist community, everybody keeps telling me you're the one that I've got to get. So that's how, and I said, well, I'll talk about a format with you, but I'm not promising you that I'm going to agree to it. And I liked her, she liked me, I liked what she had to say.
And it
went on from there. We were originally commissioned by Living TV to make 20 episodes. And we were halfway through the daily showing of those 20 episodes when Living TV contacted me and said, we love it, it's doing really well, we want you to do another 40.
Right.
And that went on from that, and we ended up making 140 episodes of The Sixth Sense, which is still shown every day, even now. And it led on to the other TV work they've done, you know, like the TV specials that we did, and then the TV series we did for Zone Reality called Psychic Private Eye. And then I made a TV series out in New Zealand a couple of years back for TVNZ. So, you know, one thing has really led on from the other.
What are you doing at the moment? Obviously, I know the tour's happening, and you tell us a little bit about
The tour's an annual thing and takes up, you know, quite a lot of my time because we start in February and we usually end in early December, so it runs throughout the year. I've got a new book coming out in April. This is my third book, which is called The Message. And lots of exciting things happening this year. A couple of new TV series maybe later in the year, which is being worked on at the moment.
Right. A couple of questions I want to ask you before we conclude, if that's all right. And these are questions based on what people ask me on this show, and obviously I'm not in a position to answer them. So speaking to an expert, this is my opportunity. The dead can't hurt you.
Mostly that is true.
Yeah.
Mostly that is true. No, they can't hurt you. They exist as a person, as a being still, but they are, if you like, dimensionally slightly removed from us because, you know, they've moved on to a different state of existence. I think what people worry about is, in this thing of can they hurt you, I think that if someone passes over, has had problems, difficulties, hurt, angry, sometimes they can invoke fear in people. And that can be damaging.
Right.
But then, you know, someone once said to me, you know, do you ever deal with evil spirits? And I said, well, just by calling these spirits evil, you empower them. You empower them to be negative.
Right.
And I've always thought of them as sort of like damaged souls. And someone from the other side of life once said to me, if all you want to do is love the lovable in life, you've missed the point. And I think there have been occasions when I've tried to help these damaged souls just to leave all this negativity behind and just move on.
Right.
But that is where the damage can come about, when people allow these negative and damaged souls to bring about fear with them, and it's the fear that's damaging.
Well, the other question I've got to ask, in the field of paranormal investigation, right, methods of communication employed by organisations, I would imagine the most obvious one is your personal ability and what you can actually communicate with. But what about things like Ouija boards and glass divination? Do you have an opinion on those, Colin?
I think within experienced mediums, I think it's something that, you know, if we do those type of seances, it can be kept under reasonable control because if you're working with experienced mediums, they have the ability to say, no, this is not right, what's coming through at this break, we stop. I generally tend to toe the line of what most mediums tell the general public is don't muck around with these things.
Yeah.
The reason being is that usually when people do, and the occasions when I've been called in to sort out problems when people have been playing around with the Ouija boards, is that it's usually done in the sense of it all being something quite hilarious and a bit of a joke,
yeah,
and
yeah,
they're deliberately going out to seek the thrill or the scare factor with it. You know? And then, of course, when it does go wrong and they attract exactly what they were setting out for, whether they were doing it consciously or not, they can't deal with it and they can't handle it. And so I generally tell people, yeah, follow the accepted advice on this and don't go messing around with the Ouija boards. It is an instrument that is best left for experienced mediums to work with. And to be quite honest, it's such a laborious way of getting communication. Most professional mediums now say, no, it's too slow, it's too laborious, and it's not worth the effort. We would rather work with other mediumistic faculties that we have.
Right. What would you say has been the most compelling thing that has ever happened in your life in terms of your mediumship, what you've seen, or any message that you've been given?
There are a number. I can give you a type of message that I think that I find most compelling and I find moves me. It's when you get someone coming to you and they say, you gave me a message and it changed my life.
Yeah.
And you know, a member of the public will take the trouble to come and tell you that message you gave me. You know, incident last year, I was on the Underground in London with my manager, and I actually don't like the tube trains very much. And there was a lady sitting opposite me. She said, "Oh, hello, Colin." Well, you know, I'm actually quite used to people saying hello to me now. And I said, "Hello, dear." And she said, "You don't remember me, do you?" And I said, "I'm sorry, I'm afraid I don't." I said, "Do forgive me." And she said, "Back in 1989, she said, I came to see you, and you gave me a message from my husband." And she said, "And I have to be honest, I was on the point of committing suicide." And she said, "But you changed my life, and you gave me a reason to carry on living again with the message." And she said, "I've never had the chance to thank you."
Mm.
And it's when people come and talk to you like that, and you get the letters from the public saying that message that you gave me.
That's the payback,
isn't it? Or even sometimes someone will write to me and say, "I was at one of your shows and you gave a message to somebody and I could so relate to it. It made me rethink my life."
Mm.
And then you realise, even on the dark days, and we all have dark days, you know, the dark days when you get a few self-doubts, when you get a letter like that, you just think, that's why I do this.
That is the payoff, isn't it?
I've got the gift.
Yeah. So I would have thought, though, you know, when you do the stage shows and all that kind of stuff, there is a bit of a danger with that, because if you are picking up on something, and perhaps maybe somebody in the audience could be there with his bit on the side, and, you know, you're getting this message coming through, or perhaps maybe he's there with his wife and he's up to no good or something like that, and that they may turn around and say, "I don't understand what you're saying. I don't understand what you're saying." And then perhaps maybe backstage, and I'm sure this has happened to you many times, they come up and say, "Listen, I knew I could take all that, but I couldn't agree to it at the time."
Yes. I've had that on a number of occasions. When people have come to me and said, "I couldn't accept the message because I was with someone else in the family and they didn't know."
Right, yeah.
You know, or it's a family secret that they don't know about.
Mm.
And then sometimes you do get a sense when you're working with a particular message, and I do it quite often, where you'll give a member of the audience so much of a message that there are other parts of this message, but I think I better speak to you privately. Come and see me after the show.
Yeah. Because, I mean, obviously, you know, people will be looking, thinking, "Oh, he's not getting that right." And then you can understand the fact that people have to be a little bit, operate with a bit of discretion there, but it still doesn't make the show any better, does it? Doesn't help, does it? People think, "Well, you're not getting the message."
No, but, you know, what quite often when I say to people when they say, "No, I don't understand," I say, "Please go and check," because that often proves to be the best evidence when it's something that you don't know and you have to go and find out.
Right.
And that often proves to be, you know, the best message is, I mean, I was doing a show the other night, and I'd been at that venue last year, and a girl came up to me and said, "You know, Colin," she said, "I couldn't understand anything you told me. I knew the people you were talking about, but I couldn't understand any of the details." She said, "But I did go and check with my arm team," and she said, "and it was all correct."
Right. Fantastic.
And she said, "And you were absolutely right. You told me it would be the best evidence for me because I didn't know."
Right. Do you have a website, Cole?
I do. It's www.colinfry.com.
Great stuff. Well, listen, Colin, it's been wonderful speaking to you this morning. I look forward to hopefully catching you up when you get up in this neck of the woods.
I'm very much looking forward to it.
And that's this week's podcast from the Roy Bessner Show on City Talk 105.9. Don't forget, you can join me live on the radio each weekday morning between 2 and 6am on City Talk across the North West and North Wales on 105.9 FM or DAB Digital Radio. And of course, you can listen live online at citytalk.fm. That's it for now. We'll catch you next time.
City Talk 105.9, the best of Roy Bassnett. Listen, and log on to the voice of Liverpool. City Talk 105.9.